Hello and welcome, and thank you for listening to the latest installment of Bardo's Blatherings, the podcast where we shine a light on the curious, the shadowy, and the often very magical history of the Scottish borderlands. Mary, are we well?
I am well. How are you?
Not too bad at all. I thought today, you know, I work with language students based in Germany, working at companies like Volkswagen and Siemens and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a plethora of social media outlets. I think it's time, now that we've been going for a year or two and we've built up, as Will would say, a corpus of work, that we spend today chatting about some of the questions we're often asked.
Yes, that's a good idea.
So why don't we today do a little Q&A?
A little Q&A of listeners' questions.
Yeah. I encourage my language students to listen to a podcast, maybe not to improve their understanding of the English language, but of our history. And I'm from time to time asked a number of questions, but you, through your social media, I'm sure get a lot of feedback.
Yes, I get a few questions.
But before we get into that, I have a question for you.
Oh dear.
I'm by way of being a listener too, because I check what nonsense have I spoken on the last episode. And as an author of a few books and an expert on the witch hunts and witch trials, especially the Bardo's witch hunts and witch trials, and your recent book about Agnes Finney.
Yeah.
I can't do quotation marks on the radio, but the Witch of Potter Row up in Edinburgh. How do you feel when you hear someone like ex-Prime Minister Boris Johnson talk about the COVID inquiry in terms of being a witch hunt?
Yes, that rankles with me. Witch hunts were and are incredibly violent things, and people die.
Yeah.
People are treated abysmally.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why I dislike to use the word witch hunt is that there are still people today, predominantly women, some children, who are killed as witches around the world.
Yes.
The last figures I'm aware of are from 2019, when something like 20,000 people around the world were killed because they were suspected of being witches. Mm. There are countries where if the harvest fails, people will turn up in the village and say, you've got a witch in your village. They will grab a child and they will chain the child up and say, we'll starve the witch out of the child. And I mean, that's just an horrific thing to do. These are witch hunts that are going on today. So for a politician, and they all do it, Boris Johnson claims it's a witch hunt, and Donald Trump claims that the hounding of him is a witch hunt. I'm thinking, no, it's not. You are not going to be taken from your family. You're not going to be tortured. You're not going to be executed. You're not going to be lonely and frightened and scared in a jail cell with nobody to help you. So, yeah, it's one of those phrases that I understand why it's used, because it's very evocative and, you know, it's a great soundbite. But I think it's a big misuse of the English language.
In a similar tone, you know that having lived and worked in southern Turkey near the Syrian border and lived among Muslim people, they used to rail at the term crusade,
because it was two very different things.
David Cameron talked about a crusade on drug, a crusade on this, and it's a very insensitive use of language, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, thank you. I did wonder how you felt about that, the use of that word. Let's move on to some of the listeners' questions that we've come across. What springs to mind? What is coming up most on your social media feeds in terms of why do you do this and why don't you?
One of the ones, and I know it's directed at me, is why do you mix myth and legend and history all in one podcast? And sometimes in the same podcast installment, why do we mix those together?
But they do mix, do they not? I mean, when we did the podcast on the two Tams, you've got a bit of factual history and a little bit of myth and legend that come together.
Yes, that's why. And I say this so many times. People are tired of hearing me say it. Story is in the word history for a reason. and it is the story of human beings. And sometimes it is 100% true, and sometimes it is 100% fantasy, and sometimes it is a mix of the two. And so I'm quite at ease if you take Robert the Bruce with his little spider in his cave.
Yeah.
I've no idea if he ever did sit in a cave with a spider, but it's a story. It's a nice way to introduce children to Robert the Bruce. It's a nice way of talking about his struggles and how you keep on trying, keep on trying. It is, and it has become part of the legend of Scottish history.
Yeah.
You see, so you'll say phrases like the legend of Scottish history, or the history of legends, or the history of myths. So I think they're all in the same pot, if you like. I think we have to be careful if, going back to the podcasts we did on history, what you're using history for.
Uh-huh.
And then you have to be careful to make sure that if you're using history for, say, a political reason, you have to make sure that what you're talking about is factually correct and it isn't myth, it isn't legend. But in the round, we are a blethering podcast. So we blether about the stories of history. Some are true, some are not. Some might be true, some might not. Mm. And to me, that's part of the enjoyment of it, is talking through these stories
You're right. I like the parallel. You know, Robert the Bruce in his cave with a spider. That is perpetuated, and it lives with, say, the Scottish national football team. You know, how they played, you know, that they never gave up. They played like brave hearts and so on. Yeah. So you have all that myth mingling into the factual history.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, if you want a pure history podcast, there are tons of them out there.
Yeah.
And there are tons of, you know, university lecturers and great academics who will give you absolutely spot-on, historically accurate lectures. And that's great. We're a blethering podcast. We're here. To me, the greatest opening sentence of any book is, "Call me Ishmael." We bring people in for a blether.
Uh-huh.
Come on in and we'll talk about a story. Yeah. Yeah. And the story might be true. It might be false. It might be legend. It might be history. Come on in. You know, we're welcoming you into Borders Blethering to listen to a story that is based on history. It's my best defence for I don't think people are overly critical. I think they're just curious about the fact that I am a historian, but I do spend a lot of time with my toes in the lovely waters of myth and legend.
And what you've just said plays into maybe a question I get asked now and again. A number of my language students, who are largely German native speakers, or certainly, if not, are based in Germany now, often say to me, "Why love the podcast, but why have you not chosen to do this history podcast in a chronological way, from A to B, very direct?"
Uh-huh.
And you seem to be a bit sketchy on dates, Doug. You sometimes use phrases like "in the middle of the 14th century" or "around the turn of the century" or 1650-ish. Now, it may be a cultural thing. It may be that German people are looking for more exactitude and a clear timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So I throw that to you, Mary. Why have we chosen not to do this in a chronological way? And why are we sketchy on dates?
This goes back to the fact that I describe myself as a magpie historian.
Uh-huh.
If it's shiny and interesting, I'll swoop down after it. If we did Borders Blethering in a chronological way, then that would mean that our listeners would say, "Oh, this week it's going to be the 9th century. I'm not really interested in the 9th century.
Well done. Yeah.
I'll wait a few weeks until they hit the 12th century."
Uh-huh.
Whereas because some weeks we're in the 10th century and the next week we're in the 19th, and one week it'll be history and one week it'll be fantasy, it's interesting for us to record in that way. And I think it's more interesting for our listeners because they have absolutely no clue where we're going the following week. You know, sometimes we have things where we did our 5-week podcast on a particular murder, and we followed, that was in Victorian era, and we followed that with another Victorian era.
That's somewhat chronology,
Other than that, we jump, because history is so fascinating, and I don't want to go back to the way I was taught history at school.
No.
Which was deadly dull and turned me off because it was this happened and then that happened and then that happened and then that happened. And I find that incredibly dull.
Yeah.
And so you would maybe get one interesting thing that happened and you would, you know, you'd learn about that. And then we would go on to the next thing. Now, obviously history is connected because it is human nature. And sometimes if you're talking about one thing, you have to go back 50 years to the beginning of it. But I think it would be a bit deadly dull if we just plodded through the different centuries as if we were a little textbook. And that to me is why I don't particularly, it never occurred to me to do it chronologically.
No.
It just never occurred to me because we meet for a blether. The dates, here we go. This is why I don't work in academia, folks. Dates are absolutely great. I always think of dates as your spine. It's the backbone of history. And so you have a spine of, you know, 1066 or 1314 or any of these sorts of dates. But to me, the interesting part of history is why. Why is always an interesting question. You can go on to the internet. You can get any textbook and look up when the Battle of Bannockburn took place. It was 1314. That was drilled into me as a child. But what does that tell me?
Nothing. Nothing.
Why the battle took place? Who was involved? What happened after the battle? Mm-hmm. Or even the question going into historiography is that why was that date drilled into me as a child? That's interesting. The actual date, 1314, would it really have mattered if it happened in 1315? Would it really actually have mattered?
I think not. And that's my recollection from the so-called good high school I went to, that you were deemed to be good at history if you could remember dates.
If you could remember dates. There's also the fact that dates are slippery. If you look at the First World War kicks off in 1314. Sorry, 1314, dearie me.
There you go.
Wrong dates. You see what I mean? Dates, terrible things. 1914. When did it finish?
Now, what you're doing here is you've pickpocketed my brain here, because I was going to use that. And I often do with my German language students. Mm-hmm. 1914, 1918, there's your dates.
Mm-hmm.
When did the Second World War start? 1939.
Really?
Oh, really?
Really?
There are those who would argue it started the day the Great War ended.
Yes.
And after the treaty that was signed. Yep. So dates inhibit our understanding
of
history.
In 1918, they stopped fighting on the Western Front.
On the Western Front. Yeah.
They were still fighting elsewhere.
Yeah.
The war itself did not officially finish until 1919, except that was only the major countries that were fighting. So Britain and France and Germany and the US had stopped fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of other countries were still fighting, and lots of other countries were still fighting internally.
Uh-huh.
In 1919, a series of internal battles kicked off in Austria, in Germany. And you could quite easily see, and I know that there are some historians who do see, that's exactly, you know, the 20th century was just one great big long war.
It was just a long war.
If you think of the Hundred Years' War between Britain and France, they did not fight every single day of those 100 years, but it's classed as a Hundred Years' War. So the dates, 1914 to 1918, what does that mean? You know, that means nothing to somebody who's still fighting in 1919. The Second World War officially started finished in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
That was meaningless to the soldiers who were still out in the East in 1947, who had not been demobbed. And they were flipping furious about it as well.
And there was the odd Japanese soldier in a jungle somewhere who was still fighting that war 15 years later.
Yes, yes. I mean, in the 1970s, I think it was, there were all sorts of Japanese soldiers being discovered who, as far as they were concerned, the war was still going on. So that's why dates, in a way, people get hung up about the date.
Yeah.
When did that happen? I'm thinking, I'm much more interested in the why it happened or why it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why did the ending of the First World War develop into the internal fights in Germany?
Yeah.
You know, that's much more interesting. And the other thing about dates is we have a problem with BC and AD, and we have the problems with BCE and CE. So we used to BC and AD, which was meant that any dates before Christ was born and any dates after he was born, AD.
Mm-hmm.
And then people thought, well, that's not very fair to all the other people around the world who are not Christian. And so it was changed to before the Common Era and the Common Era. But it was still fixed onto the date of Christ. And that makes no allowance for people like Jewish people who have a completely different dating system, or Chinese people who have a completely different dating system. You've also got the fact that we've changed things. We had Gregorian calendars and Julian calendars. Yep. So dates become just numbers. Mm-hmm. And do they matter? We had the alleged Dark Ages, which may or may not have lasted for 500 years. Well, that's not a lot of use to anybody. You know, what do you mean by may have lasted for 500 years? That, since when to when? Yeah. Dates get in the way of history. They are good if you need to, if you need to say that something happened in 1314 or 1914. Hopefully you don't mix them up like me. And that's fine. And that's, it's like a pin in a map. And then you can say, right, I've got that pin in the map. Now I can work around it. What was happening in the 14th century? What was happening at the 20th century?
Around that time, you see.
Around that time, yes.
There's also, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but that with an over-reliance upon dates, you get, and because I work a lot with German people, and there is a sensitivity about the Great and the Second World War, of course. I often make the point that through this 1418, 39, 45 way of looking at it, Germany somehow as a nation has become retrospectively responsible for the Great War.
Oh, yes.
And to me, that's a very illogical and unbalanced way of looking at the whole thing. So if we can move from the dates and look at the whys and the wherefores and the power brokers that led to that, we get a much better picture of what...
Yes, of what really happened.
What really happened.
Yes. Yeah. Because history is the study of human beings and their nature. Yeah. The date's not that important, really. I mean, there are some things that do matter with dates, obviously. I mean, you need to know if something is in the 14th century or the 17th century. You need to know those sorts of dates. But as I say, if the Battle of Bannockburn had taken place in 1315, would that have changed my understanding of the battle?
I think not.
You know, so dates, I think, are not as important. They do not have that level of importance that we assign to them, not in history.
And now you go into, we do know the local primary school. Do you have teachers in the education system caught up with what we're talking about? Is history taught differently now in
primary school? Yes, and in most secondary schools, yes. Yeah. It's much more... it's brought in with topics such as geography and sociology and these sorts of things. It's much more the human experience rather than this line of dates. Because I remember at school being taught all these dates in the way I was taught all the capitals of all the countries of Europe. I'm not quite sure why I was taught that, but I just learned it by rote. Mm. I didn't have any understanding. I mean, I wasn't told why was Paris the capital of France. I was just told it was.
Yeah.
I wasn't told, you know, why is Madrid a capital? I wasn't told why, you know, why the Spanish people decided that that was where they were going to put their capital. I was just given this list of capitals to learn. I was just given this list of dates to learn.
The why is the most important question, I think.
Yes.
I wish parents wouldn't stop their kids asking that question, but I was thinking the other day, there are 5 or 6 main rivers in this part of the world, but we sit in Berwick-upon-Tweed, wearing a tweed jacket. We don't sit in Berwick-upon-Leader, wearing a leader jacket, or Leader, or whatever. Why did the tweed come to dominance?
Yes. You know,
which led to Tweedy being a very, you know, common name in this part of the world. We need the dates much less relevant than the why something evolved.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. You'll get people who get caught up in the date as to when Scotland became a Christian country, for example. Well, the trouble is that it didn't all happen in one day. People just didn't get up on the Monday morning and say, right, okay,
Monday morning, today
let's all become Christians. That's a good idea. Yeah. It happened gradually over several hundred years in different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is, why did it take up when it did? Why did it last longer in some areas? Why is it more embedded? That's much more interesting than saying it started off in the 5th century and was complete by the 9th or whatever the dates might be. And there's also the fact that, remember going back to our podcast on archaeology, once you get into really deep history, dates become almost meaningless.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we said about, you know, Westminster Abbey, you could dig up the bones of Edward the Confessor and you could dig up the bones of somebody more recent, and there's 1,000 years roughly between us. Well, what's that going to tell you? You know, it's much more why was it built, why did it change, and what was it used for is much more interesting than when was the first stone laid. I think we get too hung up on dates.
So I hope Johannes in Munich will to some extent answered the question.
He might not agree, but at least he knows why, or rather why we do not.
Factual dates.
I shall try in future to stick some factual dates in there, but you know I'm not going to stick to that, so I don't even know why I bothered saying it.
But no, it's a question, it links to the language training I do, because I'm often asked, Doug, is that right or wrong? You know, this need to be exact, and I will often argue that English is a little bit more flexible than that.
Well, there you are. Now, that combines our thing about myth and history and dates.
Yeah.
Charlemagne's PR team put it out that he was crowned by the Pope on Christmas Day. Now, he wasn't. He was nowhere near the Pope on Christmas Day. But that became, because it was the date that Christ was born, was the date on which he was crowned, therefore he was the Holy Roman Emperor. It was a PR stunt, but they used that date as part of propaganda. And that came down as a historical fact until a few folk did a bit of digging and said, well, he couldn't have been, he was nowhere near Roma at that time. So that's why dates, sometimes, although you think, oh, well, that's a fixed date, I know where I am with that, dates might not be correct. Dates are very slippery.
He's born on the same day every year, but he dies and rises again on different dates, does he not?
Yes, don't ask me about why Easter moves about. That's a whole other podcast just there. Yes,
so let's move from dates in that case.
Yes. Was that a vague enough answer, do we think?
I hope. Other people were looking for a more exact answer.
Sorry.
But I think, we've covered ish the inexactitude. One thing.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
I must, and I'm sure you are, why don't we script these to produce a more professional podcast.
To try and stop me getting the dates wrong. Is that the idea?
Well, it's exactly because you can say the Great War started in 1314.
There you go. Away.
I've been asked that a few times. So if I ask you that same question, why don't we script this?
I think it would be a very different podcast. And
yeah, we'd have to do dates.
We'd have to do dates for a start. I'm not sure the podcast would come across quite as naturally because I genuinely don't know half of the questions you're going to ask me. So you'd have to write that down as a script. I'd then know what the questions were in advance. Mm. I would then write my answer to that. But what would happen, as I know this would happen, by the time we came to recording, I'd have changed my mind as to what answer I wanted to give you.
Me too.
I know that sometimes when I'm talking, it will spark another question in you because I've said something and you thought, oh, jings. So if that wasn't already in the script, it wouldn't work that way because we feed off each other in the podcast.
Yeah.
You know, I will try as much as possible to have a go at the Kirk of Scotland and you will try as much as possible to bring in Brexit. Mm-hmm. Now, if we've got that scripted and they're not in there, I think we'd both get a bit frustrated.
Yeah.
But to be fair, I don't think it would work as well because the questions and answers that we throw at each other, I think makes it more spontaneous and more interesting and much more fun for us to do.
Yeah.
And I hope more fun for people to listen to.
I hope so too. Although, that said, that's a little linking phrase I was doing with students. That said, Laura Kunzweg.
Oh, yes.
That said, we have a little bit of experience because when we did the multi-part podcast, Murder in Style, the story of Eliza Clafton, we were in a way forced to look at this chronologically and to script a bit.
We
because
had to
you
script
in particular
a bit,
were pouring through hundreds and hundreds of documents, source documents.
Yeah.
And then we did the tie-up with the local Amateur Dramatic Society on the Hobgreave story.
Yeah.
And I can remember Jeremy wishing to script that to death.
Yes.
Actors, you know.
Yeah.
And in both cases, I found that less natural and in some kind of mental way, a lot more tiring.
Yes, yes.
Than just speaking.
Yeah. What worried me about both of those instances was I kept worrying that we'd missed something out the script that I couldn't add in. I didn't feel as free to add in or go round in a complete circle and start talking about something else again or adding something on. So I understand for some people scripting things is absolutely the way to go. It just doesn't feel natural to us. Mm. So I think that's why we don't do it. Although I am aware, I listen to a lot of podcasts which are heavily scripted and they're excellent. It's just a different way of doing it.
Yes.
That's all it is. It's just a different way of doing it.
Yes, I don't think there's much I can add to that because you and I are not debating a change of direction. I know we're both comfortable with the...
No, but it's interesting that people ask, you know, or you know, they're wondering, are all the ums and ahs and Mary's wrong dates, have you scripted those?
Have you scripted that?
Well, you never know. Who was the great British comedian that would come on stage and it was thinking of Frankie Howard. And this is showing my age, but Frankie Howard, for those that don't know him, would come on stage and it was, I'm not sure. All of that was scripted, apparently.
Uh-huh.
He scripted every and every into his performance. And the skill that he had was that it didn't sound scripted.
That was part of his act.
Yes.
I think Mockham and Wise were going back in time, but gave the impression of ad-libbing.
Yes.
But they were ad-libbing to a script.
To a script.
Strict script.
And there's a real talent there to taking something scripted and turning it into something that sounds ad-lib. That's real acting talent there. Yeah. And
sorry, Mary, just to interrupt. It says on my script here, cough.
There we go. Right.
Excellent. Yeah, no, you're right. That talent of appearing to be ad-libbing
when you're walking to a script. Yes, amazing, amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, why don't we script it? So I think we've answered that question.
I think so.
Another question I've been asked, and I'm not quite sure how to react to this, is why do we focus on the history of the borders?
Mm-hmm.
Exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I could be churlish and, in my opinion, downright impolite and say, well, the clue's in the name. You know, we are called Borders Blatherings. But I often throw that back to some of my language students and say, talk to me about your understanding of Scottish history, your perception, your experience, if you visited the country, as a conversation topic. And what I hear often is an understanding of our history, Scotland's history, that is pretty much dressed up in tartan and the Highlands and Braveheart.
Yeah.
And that is really that the source material are books and movies made about Scotland's history. I've had a few things, even in the local community centre, someone said to me, there were Lowland clearances. I knew all about the Highland clearances, but there were Lowland. And I said, that's really what we're trying to do, is to say a lot of stuff happened here.
Yes.
A lot of what happened in the UK and further afield had a major social, economic, cultural impact on this part of the world. And because neither of us are natives of the book, I'm learning as I go along how rich the history of this part of the world actually is. But no one at school led me anywhere near the history of this part of the world.
Yes, I would agree. That's why, I mean, initially we'd wanted to set up the podcast and we talked about, you know, we would talk about Scottish history or Scottish politics. We realised they're intertwined, obviously, and where would we base it? And I think both of us realised that the Highland stuff, the Highland history that is out there is amazing. It's huge. It's difficult to understand. And it's Gaelic, and my Gaelic pronunciation is really bad. And it's very difficult to understand without a base history. I think every podcast would have to start with an explanation of the Lord of the Isles or the Gaeltacht or the clan system. And I felt that would have dragged a little bit. But you're right, if you look at the borders, it's just everything that has happened happens here because it is on a border. Borders are incredibly interesting because of that. You know, the wars of independence between Scotland and England were not fought in the Highlands. They were fought in the borderlands. We're so close to Edinburgh, the main capital, where we're on the east side of the country, so we're close to Europe. So there's all sorts of things happening here and bubbling away here. There's lots of interesting history, and as you say, very few people know about it. So that, to me, was why it was interesting. And again, for me, it was a learning curve. It was, oh, James, right, okay, that happened here. And taking the Scottish history that I knew and then applying it to the borders, how would that have had that effect on the little ferrum tunes that the borders was awash with at one time? So, yes, I find that fascinating. Yeah. I've always been fascinated by things on the either people or places that are on edges or near borders. It's where interesting things happen.
Yeah, indeed.
And there's a wealth of material that people just don't know anything about. We keep finding things out ourselves. Just literally, you think, oh, wow, I did not know that. We live in the village of Stow. We had not heard about the murder.
Yeah.
You know, it's a prime example of things that are going on. So it's not that we don't do Highland history because we don't like it, or we don't do the history of Shetland and Orkney because we don't like them. It's just there's a treasure trove in the borders. And we could be doing this podcast in 10 years' time and we still won't have got to the bottom of that treasure trove.
Exactly,
I'm sure.
That, yeah. And it's why in my unscripted introduction I use the phrase shine a light, because at Hollywood, for example, has largely ignores this the history of this part of the world. And yet, to those people that I talk to on a regular basis, they're clued up on their Rob Roys, their Culloden's, their Bravehearts, all of that history.
Yeah.
The tartanization of it all.
Yeah.
Which is not to downplay it at all.
No.
But it's a rather skewed view of Scotland as a whole.
Because if you speak to most people about the borders, they'll say common ridings, mills, and rugby.
Yeah.
And that's it. Mm-hmm. That's a whole area of Scotland just dismissed with those three things. Yeah. And there's just so much more.
Yeah.
And then when you start to peel away the layers, you suddenly go, oh, wow, that's here. Oh, I didn't know about that. And, you know, it is fascinating. as all of Scotland history is, but we've got our little treasure trove, and we're bringing it out to the world so that everybody else can find out.
You can understand
as well
why I was a little bit surprised when someone said, "Oh, I didn't know there were lowland clearances." That really played into this point I'm trying to make about where the emphasis is placed in terms of our history.
Yeah. Or you'll say to people, you know, how do you think the English troops got up to Edinburgh during the Wars of Independence? How do you physically think they got there? Now, some did go up by ship, but the others came up by foot. Where do you think they went? Mm-hmm. How do you think they physically got there? And suddenly go, "Oh, yeah, they would have marched through the borders." And I said, "Yes."
Yeah.
And what happens to the local population when an invading army marches through the place?
And what role did the abbeys play? And so on and so forth.
And you
absolutely
suddenly think, "Oh, yeah, actually, there's a ton of history there."
Yeah.
So, that's, I think the borderlands of any country are fascinating.
Yeah.
And we're lucky enough to live here and able to explore the shadowy and magical borderlands.
Yeah. Yeah. No, maybe that's an idea for if I ever manage to get a holiday this year. Maybe we could have a blather at some point about the idea of the border. Yeah.
Yes.
Having, you know, when I lived in Brussels, I hadn't realized, and you know, that there were people who considered themselves German who were actually living in Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
But when I investigated the border region, I thought, wow.
Yeah.
This is a real mishmash of language.
You go to the southern border of the Netherlands, and there are towns inside the Netherlands that are Belgian.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that people think of themselves as Belgian. I mean, they are.
Yeah.
Part of the country of Belgium, even though they are geographically inside that southern border with the Netherlands.
Yeah.
So, I think a holiday podcast. Let's both toodle off on a holiday, see where we go. And I might actually choose to go as far away from the Scottish borders as I can. I might go up to Orkney or Shetland and see what's happening up there, because I've not been up there for a while.
Indeed.
Yeah. So, oh dear, we've now got to a stage where we're planning future podcasts within this podcast. But, that's why it's not scripted. That's why it's not scripted.
Yeah.
Things come into our heads and we decide.
It was just the thought with what you were saying, because the sheer geographical location of this part of the world has been so important in terms of general Scottish history.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
It has indeed.
It's been isolated often by the Hygieians in Edinburgh, for example, during the, if I say the Black Death, you'll correct me.
That's quite all right.
Yeah. And so on and so forth. So, Mary, thank you. That's been, I hope, a few kind of answers to some of the questions. Is there anything else that has popped up on your social media?
Those have been the main questions we've had, although we have had a few that have wondered if I could slow down my speech a little, because apparently your speech is wonderful and they can understand you perfectly and I speak too quickly.
But you're a Ouija, and that's what
people
should
expect.
What can
I say? I'm from the West, this is how we are.
And as I say, one of my students, and I've told you this before and may have mentioned it on a podcast, said to me, it was Rita, "Is Mary a real Scottish woman?" And I could not get to the bottom of that.
I'm fascinated as to what nationality she thinks I might be.
But it does open the doors to a conversation.
It does indeed.
What do you understand by Scottish, Rita?
There you go.
Okay, Mary, thank you very much. Until we meet again for the next unscripted blether, take care.
Okay, bye for now.
Bye for now.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz, and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.